Good morning, everybody. I'm Mike Allison, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February the 12th, 1990. And my home group is the Brentwood Full Moon Group outside of Nashville, Tennessee. We meet on Friday nights at 6:30. It's an open discussion meeting. We also have a newcomers meeting. There's an Al-Anon meeting and Al-Teen down the hall, too. So it's a great place to come and recover. And anytime you're in Nashville, I hope you'll look me up in the phone book and come see us. It's a real privilege to be here today. This is such a cool weekend. I'm having the time of my life. I hope everybody else is too. This is great. I'm here with my people, and I'd like to thank Sam for inviting me to come out here, and for Andy for just, I mean, he and I have just really hit it off. And you know, we have this alcoholic chemistry that I can, you know how it is. And it's just a wonderful thing. There just aren't any strangers when you go to a thing like this. And thanks for the rest of the committee for all the hard work they've done. I appreciate the bag in the room full of goodies. It had all kinds of good organic, great things to eat. Of course, I ate all the chocolate first, so I'm going to get that over with. And I really enjoyed the speakers that I've gotten to listen to so far, and I look forward to the ones that are yet to come. And the ones I've missed, I'm really grateful that Lee is here to record these. Cassettes were a big part of my early recovery. My sponsor would just give them to me. He wouldn't say, "Do you want to listen to this?" He'd say, "Listen to this." And it was a voice louder than my head a lot of times when I was in the car. And speaker tapes have always helped me a lot. And it's a wonderful service you do, Lee. And you know, on page 152, it says that we'll make lifelong friends. And this is just a benefit. And I've known Lee a long time, and I'm just so grateful he's in my life. It's really good to see him here. I hate to follow the Al-Anon speakers. Jenny gave a wonderful story, but I feel some kind of a... I don't like to speak after my wife's Al-Anon talk because, you know, in AA we have As Bill Sees It, but the Al-Anons have Lois Remembers, and there's a big... There's a big difference. So much of what I say may be hearsay. I don't know, but I'm. But in the big book, among all the promises we have in the big book, besides on 83 and 84, we read all the time, there's all kinds of promises. And there's one on page 23 for the Al-Anons that are in here. It says, "Once in a while, he may tell the truth." So I'm going to try to do that today. And I was reading the daily reflections this morning, and it says, "We recovered alcoholics are not so much brothers in virtue as we are brothers in our defects and in our common strivings to overcome them." That was in Bill Sees It, page 167, and that's a lot of what I'm going to share today. My parents drank a lot as far back as I could remember. And I always got the message that they drank after work, and they celebrated, and they partied with their friends, and they had a good time, and they'd unwind from work, and sometimes they'd drink too much, and bad things would happen. And I guess I got the message that, you know, you just overshoot the mark every now and then. And if you just drank the right amount, they had a good time. And I never thought about not drinking. Their drinking didn't affect me that much. So when I started drinking in the early teenage time, I overshot the mark the first night, actually. And I got really, really sick. And I just thought, I overshot the mark. You know, I just drank a little too much, but I was having a really good time until, you know, I blacked out. So I just started drinking. I didn't think anything about it. And I gravitated to kids that were drinking like me. And that became a part of my life, and I never really realized from the get-go that my drinking was abnormal. My wife's one of those people that is a normal drinker, whatever that is, and she might order a glass of wine sometime, and she might not, which I don't understand. If you can get a drink, why would you have a choice? But and she sometimes won't finish it, and I'll be staring at the glass like, "Are you going to finish that?" Which makes no sense to me. And if she does, I've said, you want another glass of wine? And she'll say, "No, I don't want any more. I'm starting to feel it." So I just don't get that. And I didn't hang around with people like that. But I didn't know that that alcohol did something different to me. I never realized that. I thought everybody drank got the same effect out of it, but apparently they don't, because I want to go to the party after a few drinks and they don't. So I started surrounding myself with people and building drinking around my life. I was not a very good student. I went to college for 4 years. I was one of those guys that start off and do things, you know, with good intentions. I put my intentions right up there with anybody, but I never would finish anything. And I dropped out of college lacking just 6 hours of getting a degree in business management, and I went to work for a family business that my parents had started about the time I was born. And I was already working for this business because my dad was away a lot, and the only way I got to see him was to work for the business. And I also got some self-esteem because he appreciated my hard work and ability, and I learned that from him. So that's the only time I really connected with him was in our work. And also it made me the money I wanted to be the party guy that I was becoming. So I stumble through college, and I drop out of college, and I come back home, and right before I came home from college, I met my wife, and we started dating, and it was just great for a while. But then I noticed she just wanted to manage me a little bit more than I wanted to be. It seemed like she just had all kinds, you know, I'd have ideas and she'd have different ones, and we'd wind up doing it her way. So after about a couple of years, I just couldn't stand it anymore, and I just broke it off with her. I broke the relationship off. I couldn't take it. I didn't have any communication skills then, so I didn't know how to deal with that. So I just said, we're through. And actually, I didn't tell her till a couple of years ago why I really did it. But so we broke up for a year, but I really liked this girl. And she would always invite me to her apartment when she'd have parties and always be with somebody to try to reel me in, which that worked apparently. And about a year went by, and I had to have my wisdom teeth out. And so they give you a whole bunch of drugs to knock you out to do that, and they gave me all these narcotics to put me down for take my wisdom teeth out. And this guy from my office drives me home because I can't drive. And when I get back to my apartment, I start writing on a napkin because I can't talk with this mouth full of gauze. And, you know, called Diane and wrote her work number down, and so this guy just picks up the phone. He didn't know that I'd been broken up with her for a year. And he calls up and says, hey, Diane, Mike's had his wisdom teeth out and wants you to come over here because his parents are out of town to help him out. And she's thinking, George who? Mike who? You know, she was living with some other guy. But she came over to my apartment, and I'm sitting there just whacked out on these drugs. And by the way, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm a real alcoholic. But I like party favors too, so anything that'll supercharge my drinking, I'm bring it on. So I'm in there, and I'm writing on this piece of paper, I love you, I want you back, you know, move in with me. You know, we go A to Z, and she did, and that was in March 18th of 1975. We've been together ever since, and we celebrate Tooth Day every year on March 18th. And the only reason I tell you that, though, is that I'm in my early 20s by this time, but I can't get past my fear and my pride and my ego to tell this woman I really loved her and I wanted her back without being loaded. I couldn't do anything dead sober. I was getting just terrified dead sober. And my alcoholism was going on then. So she and I get married. We have two kids. We have two sons. They're 36 and 32 now. I have wonderful relationships with both of them. I missed a lot of their lives when I was growing up, and I know I can't get back some of that, but I've really tried my best to build a relationship with both of them. And before I run out of time, I really want to talk about that. Because of AA and Al-Anon, I've got a marriage today that's just a blessing. I shouldn't have the marriage that I have, and I'll tell you why in a little while. But my children are grown. In the depths of my alcoholism, when things got bad, I wanted to kill myself all the time. I never had a plan, but I just thought I'd be better off if I wasn't here. And I went through that depression and that anxiety of just not wanting to live for a long time up until I was 39 when I got sober. And all that time where I just thought I'd be better off not being here, and I checked my life insurance policies to see if they were current. I thought, well, my family would be taken care of. And, you know, they didn't want the money. They wanted a sober father and a sober husband. But at that time, I never would have dreamed then, when I thought things couldn't be any better, that I'd have this 13-year-old granddaughter that I have right now that's just the apple of my eye. I never had a grandfather, and now I get to be one. She's never seen me take a drink. Those kind of gifts. I sold myself so short back then. I just couldn't see beyond the alcoholism that I was living in. You know, I had some success in this business after we got married. I was buying the right stuff and spending a lot of money, and that'll make the promises come true for a little while. But inside, I felt this emptiness. That it was like as my drinking progressed, I was just rotten on the inside. I just felt like I was a phony. Like, you know, I really didn't deserve any of this stuff, and that if you really knew me, you wouldn't have anything to do with me. And I had these feelings, but I could block them out best I could. But I started doing some really crazy things. I was in the landscaping business for a long time. Actually, I was in the grass business, the legal kind. And we live up on a really high hill in Nashville. It's one of the highest houses in the county, as a matter of fact. And it's a long dead-end street. And most of my neighbors, nearly all of them, don't have any landscaping at all. Their houses, they just build their houses in the woods. But when I move up there, I think I'm this big shot landscape guy, and I want to show off all my expertise. So I'm trying to grow some grass in front of my house, and the trees would keep shading out the grass in the summertime, and then in the fall the leaves would fall off and choke the grass out on the ground, and I'd have to redo it. And I thought, well, this is not making me look very good. So I thought, well, I'll just cut all my trees down and solve that problem. And that probably would have been a pretty good idea, but I really didn't know where my property line was on one side of me. I knew where it was on the street, but our lots go way down the steep hill. I mean, we've lived there over 35 years, and I've been down there maybe two or three times. I mean, it's straight up and down just about. But I go stumbling down this hillside with a plat where I bought my lot and a compass. And I start looking around, and I somehow find this iron pin in the ground, and I convince myself that that's my property line. And so I called a surveyor up then, and I said, look, I've found my property line, but I can't see the line all the way up to the street. I need you to mark this line for me. And these guys came out there with their transits and everything, and they kind of looked at me, and they said, you know, we don't think this is right. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. I got this laser beam focus, and when I make up my mind I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it, you know, and I'm paying you so you do it my way. I'm right. And so these guys said, okay. So they start putting these stakes in the ground coming up this hillside, and lo and behold, when they got up between my next door neighbor's house and mine, the flags and stakes are almost touching his house. Now, you know, a sane person would have thought, well, maybe these guys know what they're talking about. You know, I've since found out that, you can just call a surveyor up and tell them you need to find a property line. They'll come do it for you. You don't even need to tell them where you think it is. Not me, though. I'm a bright guy, you know, so. But the first thing goes through my crazy mind at that time is, man, that old goat, he's been using my property all these years. You know, he moved up here and built his house right on the line, and he's, you know, moving it over on me. Well, as I said, I didn't have any communication skills whatsoever dealing with people, and I wasn't about to wait till he got back from Florida with his wife where he was to discuss this with him. I'm getting these trees cut down, so I call a friend of mine that had a tree surgery company, and he sends two bucket trucks and a whole bunch of guys with chainsaws, and they cut all these trees down in between us. And it was a lot of trees. It was a lot of trees. It was according to a jury of my peers, it was $50,000 worth of trees. Because when my next-door neighbor got home a few days later, he was not happy with my surveying, and he successfully sued me. And he was so mad that he was so angry that he asked for a jury trial, which was unusual in a civil case like that. But I had to sit through a two-day jury trial for cutting this guy's trees down. And I'm sitting there, and I've got a three-piece suit on that I've sweated all the way through. You remember those good old days? I sweated all the way through this three-piece suit, and I'm eating these blue Valiums that I had stashed in my pocket to try to remain calm and together while his attorney clearly portrayed me as an absolute lunatic for cutting these trees down. And after 2 days, they awarded in his favor. They gave him the $50,000, and they gave him $5,000 punitive damages that he didn't even ask for, and that really made me mad. And by this time, I'm convincing myself that, you know, it could have happened to anybody. I didn't really mean to do it. You know, I never took responsibility for my actions. I would always turn it around, and I never realized I was doing that. I'm not making excuses for it. I just never realized it. But I learned how to do that really, I say really good, but really bad. When I got to the depths of despair and I was told that I ought to go to treatment, I remember asking my wife, you know, do you think if I go to this treatment thing that it'll help me with my relationship with my father? Because he and I were just at each other's throats then. And she didn't want to answer, but she said, yeah, it probably will. And, you know, the only reason why I asked her that was if it didn't work out, I could blame her. You know, that's where alcoholism takes me. So after my neighbor sues me, I mean, I hate this guy. And, you know, we live on a dead-end street. If I'd see him driving down the street, coming in my lane, I'd ease my car over in his lane like I was playing chicken with him. I'd curse at him when he got his mail. I was just horrible to this guy. My wife and my young sons would go over and visit this man's wife during the day while I was at work, and that relationship was just stopped when all this happened. Now, Diane's since gone to, she says this in her Al-Anon story, and I have her permission to say this. She said she wouldn't, today, she would still continue the relationship with those people regardless of what I did. But she stayed on my side at that time. You know, as bad as it was that I cut the guy's trees down and he sued me, a couple of years before that, we were friends. And he knew I was in the landscaping business, and he came to me one time and he said, I want to ask you a favor. He said, my wife has always wanted a weeping cherry tree. She thinks that's the prettiest tree there is. Could you get us one of those? And I said, sure, I can do that. What else you want? He said, well, I don't know. And I said, well, go ask her if she wants anything else. So he came back a day or two later and had a couple other shrubs, bushes, something. I don't know what they were that they wanted. So I think I'm this big shot. So I send one of my crews out because I have my people then. Thank God y'all are my people now. But I send my people out, and I get this weeping cherry tree and this other bushes, and I asked the guy where he was going to plant it, and he told me. So I send my crew up there, and they plant the weeping cherry tree and these other plants. And he comes over to my house, and he said, golly, I appreciate you getting me the tree. I didn't mean for you to plant it. You know, I was just hoping you'd get it for me. And I know you're in the business, and I want to give the business to my neighbor. He said, how much do I owe you for it? And I remember sticking my chest out and saying, you don't owe me anything. It's like, look at me. Look what I can do for you. I don't need your money. You know, I got my people that can do this stuff. And I'm sure that I probably did some things for fun and for free back then, but this wasn't one of them. You know, I was just trying to show off what a big shot I was. Well, after he sued me a couple of years later, I went over there the very next night with some herbicide and put on that weeping cherry tree and killed it. And I'm on a spiritual experience panel at 1 o'clock. Come on. Well, I'm going to pull that off. This is how I was treating my next-door neighbor. I'd pull in my driveway every day, and I'd see his house, and I'd think about him suing me, and I'd get mad before I even went in to see my wife and my kids. My alcoholism was taking me to a darker place all the time. I started cheating on my wife. The very thing that I treasured the most in my life, my values that I treasured just started going down the drain. It was part of the lifestyle. And I knew it was wrong when I was doing it, and I did it anyway. And that guilt and remorse and regret was building up inside of me, but I did it anymore. I did it anyway. I was not getting along with my father. He had retired from the business and then came back 4 years later after fulfilling his commitment he had and wanted back in the business, and I wouldn't let him in. And he drank like I did, so we didn't get along, and it was just bad. He'd come to my office out and say he wanted to help me, and then he'd tell me what he was going to do to help me, and I didn't know what to do with that, so I brought my shotgun to work one day, and I decided I was going to shoot the windows and tires out of his Buick when he pulled in, and that would give him the message that I didn't want him around, which probably would have. But I didn't do it, because maybe I was afraid of him. But I went to my doctor one more time, and I'd been going to my doctor for years for depression and anxiety and migraine headaches, and he'd been giving me antidepressants and tranquilizers and painkillers and everything else, trying to help me. And of course, I'm taking all that stuff he was giving me, and all the stuff I'm buying off the street, and I'm washing it all down with Crown Royal and just trying to charge ahead, you know, the tornado roaring through the lives of others. But I go to my doctor one more time, and I said, "Look, I was going to shoot my father's Buick this morning, and I'm going crazy. What do I do?" And he said, "Well, go see this lady." And so he sent me to this psychologist, and I'd been to a bunch of those off and on over my lifetime. And I'd quit drinking on my own at times. I didn't know anything about recovery or AA, but I'd quit drinking if things got too bad or Diane was on my back about it. And I'd quit for periods of time, and I'd always think, okay, well, I've quit drinking, no more problems. Drinking's not the problem anymore. But what I didn't know was little by little, I get so uncomfortable after I hadn't drank for a while that I go crazy. And I've got to drink or do drugs again to unwind that spring that's building up inside of me. And so I quit drinking again, and I go see this lady. And I go see her on a Monday morning. And I go in there, and I wrote down on my calendar like $75 for 60 minutes. Thought I was going to get to tell her what a rotten guy my father was, and my wife was on my back, and I had these kids in private schools I couldn't afford and all this other stuff. Because our finances and marriage were really bad then. And I go in there and I sit down at her, in her house. And she said, "Well, before we get started, I want to ask you a few questions." She said, "How much do you drink?" And I said, "I don't drink." And she said, "You don't drink at all?" I said, "No, ma'am." And she said, "Well, did you ever drink?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "When did you quit?" And I said, "Thursday." I really thought that would be the end of the line of questioning, honestly. And she said, "Well, before you quit drinking, how much did you drink?" And I really didn't know, because I never ran out, ever. I had stockpiles everywhere. A good friend of mine that's been sober a long time that I drank with said I used to clink in the wintertime for the miniatures I carried in my pockets. And I never ran out, ever. And so I really don't know how much I drank, but I told her as much as I could. And then she said, "Well, do you take any drugs?" And when she asked me that, that was the first little bit of surrender that I'd had. It's like I was just tired. You know, I was 39 years old, and I really wasn't afraid of dying. I was afraid I might live in another 39 years as miserable as I was. I couldn't do it anymore. And I said, "Yeah, I take some drugs." And she said, "Well, what do you take?" And I told her all the prescriptions I had, and then I told her all the other stuff I was taking. And she said, "Well, do you have any drugs with you now?" And I reached in my pocket, and I pulled out my change, and I started going through my change, and I had 37 blue Valiums just loose in my change, and she seemed to think that was a lot. But I'd quit drinking on... Actually, I didn't quit drinking on Thursday. I found a calendar later on. I quit drinking on Friday, but I thought if I added a day to it, it'd make more sense. But I'd quit drinking on Friday, and I was a little jumpy, so I bought 100 Valiums, you know, just to take the edge off. And at that point, she said, "Well, before we go any further, I want you to have an addiction evaluation done." And I thought, "Well, wait a minute, I ain't told you about my father yet. I got real problems here." So I go see this other guy, and Diane goes with me, and we fill out these forms. And he gets us together, and he said, "You know, this really isn't rocket science. This is pretty standard stuff." And he said, "From what you've written down here," he said, "you've been an alcoholic for at least 15 years, and if you don't get some help pretty soon, you're going to die." And the first thing that went through my mind was, how could you say that in front of my wife? You know, I really think my ego will kill me to try to protect itself sometime. I mean, I think my mind would have killed me years ago, but it needs my body for transportation. But not that was the worst news anybody could give me, but that you know, my life was in danger. And he said, you need to go to treatment. You need to go to AA. And Diane hadn't been to Al-Anon yet. And she said, what can I do? And the guy said, pack his bag. I didn't like that either. But I told him, I said, look, I'm in a seasonal business. I'm in this landscaping business. And I'm laid around all winter. And I got financial problems. And I've got to work. I can't go away to a treatment center. He said, man, if you don't do something about your drinking, you don't have to worry about your business. You're going to be dead. And I said, look, I just can't do it. And he said, well, go see these people. They've got an outpatient program where you can work during the day and go at night for 6 weeks. So I go see these people. And on the way over there, I'm seeing all these billboards for treatment centers everywhere back then. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not that bad. You know, these people know I have good insurance. They just won't rip me off again. You know, I went from the point of I can't go another second like I'm living to, well, I'm not that bad. You know. And as I'm saying this, I got a loaded 9mm Smith & Wesson semi-automatic pistol in my pocket that I carried all the time. And I'm, you know, thinking about shooting my father's car and God knows what. And I'm a dangerous person, but yet, I just in a matter of seconds, I could say, well, I'm not that bad. So I go see this lady and tell her my dilemma. And she tells me about her program. I said, look, I'd love to do this, but I'm too busy now. I know how to quit drinking on my own. You know, I'll come back this fall whenever I have time, and I'll do your classes or whatever they are. And she looked at me kind of funny and said, just because you quit using doesn't mean you're going to quit hurting. And when she said that, I thought, well, what the heck does that mean? And, you know, I didn't get an answer for that for about a year after I got sober. When I came here, I really didn't know whether I was powerless over alcohol. I really didn't think I was because I could quit these periods of time. But my sponsor took me to Memphis one weekend to hear Clancy. He said, you got to hear this guy. And he took me to Memphis to hear Clancy. And Clancy said two things that just stopped me in my tracks. He said, the natural state of a sober alcoholic is growing depression and anxiety. And I thought, man, every time I quit drinking, I don't feel better after I feel better not having hangovers and throwing up all the time. But after a while, I get so uncomfortable, it's like my skin's crawling. My problem is that I'm sober. And the other thing he said was the thing that makes sobriety a fatal disease, the thing that makes alcoholism a fatal disease is that sobriety eventually becomes emotionally unbearable. And I thought, that's what I've got. And that's when I knew I had to have an answer. But this lady convinces me to go to her program. And so I go through this 6-week program. And for the first time in my life, I did everything they told me to do. They said I had to go to 5 AA meetings a week. And I thought, man, you mean 5 AA meetings? And they said, no, 5 a week. And I thought, I'm too busy. I can't do that. But, you know, I've learned I've got to participate in my own recovery. You know, I got to build my sobriety around, I got to build my life around my sobriety. I can't afford to build my sobriety around my life when it's convenient. I just can't do it. The longer I'm up here, the more I realize what a bad case of alcoholism I really have. I didn't think I was that bad when I came in because I only went to outpatient treatment. I nipped this thing in the bud. But I go to my first meeting, which was at the Full Moon Group, which is still my home group. And I remember going there, and I got there late, and the parking lot was full of cars. And I'm thinking, great, you know, the church must be meeting or doing something. I've come on the wrong night. You know, I thought this A&A thing was, you know, a couple old guys in trench coats shaking and puking on each other. I don't know what the heck it was. And I'm going across the parking lot, and this rock and roll singer is walking across the parking lot, too. And I'm thinking, what's that guy doing here? You know, he's a cool guy. He is a cool guy. He's still a cool guy. And I see him, and I think, well, maybe he belongs to this church or something, you know. And I'm embarrassed because I don't want anybody to see me at an AA meeting. You know, I park my car in front of the front door of the Cockeyed Camel every day at 5 o'clock, but I didn't want anybody to know I was in recovery. And I'm going over, and this guy comes up, and he says, can I help you? And I said, well, you're so-and-so. And he said, yeah, that's right. And I introduced myself to him. I said, man, I love your music. I go see you every time, you know, you're in town and you perform. I'm always there. And, of course, I was always whacked out of my mind when I'd go see him. And he said, well, can I help you? And I said, well, I heard there was an AA meeting here. He said, yeah, mate, you're in the right place. And this guy opened the door for me. And it floored me to know this man had 4 years of sobriety. And I remember going in that meeting, and they seemed to know I was new. And they did. a first step meeting for me, and they were telling their stories around the room, and one of the guys there who's passed away now, Joe W., and he said he'd had 2 DUIs in one day. Twice. And I'm sitting there and I'm going, I ain't had any DUIs. I'm not that bad. Now, I got that pistol in my pocket, you know, and I'm wanting to kill myself, but no, I'm not that bad. And another guy who's now my sponsor said he'd sleep with a pint of vodka and he'd wake up in the middle of the night shaking. And he'd open that pint of vodka under his pillow and drink about half of it and put the cap back on, put it under the pillow and pass out. A couple hours later, the alarm would go off. He'd kill the rest of the pint to stop shaking where he could brush his teeth and shave and go to work because he always went to work. And I thought, I'm not that bad. Now, I had those miniatures in my pocket all the time, but, you know, I don't think I'm as bad as he is. And they asked me if I had anything to say, by the way. I remember saying, well, I'm Mike. I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic, but I've got clinical depression. They still remind me of that. But my grandsponsor said if they'd known I had that pistol in my pocket that night, they wouldn't have laughed like you did. Be careful how you treat newcomers. So anyway, I get through this. I'm going to AA, and I loved AA from the beginning. I loved it. I found hope there. I still find hope there. If there's nothing else I do for the new people, is give them some hope, because anybody comes to AA doesn't have any. And Dr. Bob got it right. It's all about love and service, and I got that from the very beginning. And part of getting out of this treatment program, I had to get a sponsor the week before I got out. And so there was a guy in my home group named Buff, and I thought Buff must be president of AA because everybody liked him and said great things. And he was nice to me and gave me his phone number the first night. So I go up to him after the meeting, and I'm like I said, when I'm sober, I'm shy. I don't like conflict. I don't like rejection. I go up and I said, Buff, you know, when I get out of treatment next week, I got to get a sponsor. And he said, well, you ought to ask somebody, and walked off. So I get to do that every now and then. Isn't that fun? So I go back to him and I said, Buff, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah, we can try that. He said, I've loused a lot of my life up. I've loused a lot of finance and romance up in my life. But he said, if you'll take the 12 steps with me like I took them with my sponsor, your life will change whether you want it to or not. And maybe that's the best words anybody's ever given me, because that's been the truth. And I started following this guy and trying to do the steps the best I could with him. And, you know, where we're reading how it works, where it says that some of these we balked, I balked at all of them. You know, I'd get a little bit of relief, and then I'm trying to figure out what the next one's going to do for me before I took the action. Then that kept me sick for a while. It almost killed me. You know, at this time, I'm still wondering whether I'm powerless over alcohol, but I'm real convinced that my life's unmanageable. I didn't have a problem with Part B of Step 1. And Buff told me, he said, how's your relationship with God? And I didn't have one. I went to church with my parents, well, with my mother when I was growing up, and then when I went away to college, I quit doing that. I remember my parents would visit me in Memphis, and I'd be riding them around town, showing them the sights, and we'd go by this big Catholic church, and I'd say, well, that's where I go to Mass on Sunday. I've never been in that church in my life. But I was wanting their approval, even if it meant lying to them. I married my wife in the Catholic Church, and there was a really nice priest that married us, and he counseled us before we got married, and I hung around there a little bit, but I just never could get the message there. And I'm not knocking at it at all. Please don't hear that wrong. I was envious and jealous of people that had religious backgrounds when I got here, and I thought I was really behind the eight ball, that I was less than. And it's just me. It's not the church. For some reason, I don't connect there. But Buff told me I could have a God of my own understanding. And so he just said, why don't you get on your knees in the morning and ask God to direct your day, and then at night get on your knees and thank him for keeping you clean and sober that day. And I said, okay. And a couple days later, he said, well, how's that praying going? I said, well, I'm not doing that. He said, what do you mean? I said, I've tried, you know, that stuff doesn't work for me. And he said, Hoss, what have you got to lose? And so really, I started getting on my knees and praying just to get my sponsor off my back, really. But I'm so grateful that he did that he prevailed on me to do that, because that's a part of my regimen, that maybe that's the reason why I'm still up here. I don't know. And so I started praying to this God that I didn't understand. And as I started praying, I started getting comfortable. Something started happening a little bit. I started feeling some kind of presence and some kind of connection. And so I started adding things to the prayers that day of what I wanted God to do that day. And it got to be a pretty big, long, flowing, eloquent laundry list of things, until one day I just started laughing. I said, God, I'm trying to con you. You know, this is your job. You know, I don't need to tell you what you need to do today. So a lot of my prayers are thanks. And I still say the serenity prayer and the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer. And I just ask God to show me what you want me to do today and give me the power to carry it out. And then I get going. And throughout the day, I pray for God's will in a lot of people's lives. And they're all not prayers for things, but for thank you. And so I'm getting this. And I didn't like the third step prayer because it had these and thous in it. So I retyped it in modern English because I had this thing against the churches. So that's the way I say the third step prayer, but it says as long as the language, doesn't matter about the exact language, so I got a pass there. So I'm going to meetings and I'm living off the first three steps, and my life's getting good. Things are going a little better at home, but they're not so good. But they're, you know, I'm thinking, well, time will wear that out and it'll be better. I'm sober now. I'm going to be a better husband. And Buff kept telling me I need to start on a four step, but, you know, I was just really doing great. And I went to my home group one night and I announced in there that I really thought the promises were coming true for me, even though I was on the third step. And there was this old timer, Frank D., in there. And he said, don't get too well too quick. You're doing the alcoholic waltz. I said, what's that, Frank? He said, 1, 2, 3, drunk. 1, 2, 3, drunk. How about, the old goat, what do you know? You ain't even been to treatment like I have. You didn't know. Well, after about 10.5 months of living off the first three steps and learning the lingo and going to meetings, I got so uncomfortable with untreated alcoholism that I was ready to drink again or start doing a four-step or blow my brains out. And I really didn't know which one of the three to take. It was a terrible spot to be in. Seems like a no-brainer up here now, but I thought, well, this stuff worked for a while, but it's not working anymore. And I was terrified. And I went through a period of time where about that time that I had a complete collapse in any abilities that I thought I had. I've been in the same business pretty much all my life, and I thought, man, I don't even know what I'm doing in this business. And I thought, you know, I thought I was always God's gift to women. I may be the worst lover my wife could ever have. I mean, as a husband and a father and a man, everything just fell apart. And I called my sponsor, and I was just terrified. And he said, meet me at the clubhouse. So I go over to this clubhouse, and he gets in the back room with me, and he said, you know, whatever God you think you have, you need to fire that one and get one you can really lean on. He said, I don't know what your higher power is, but you better find another one, because you're going to need that to go have the courage to go through the rest of this program. And what it did for me is I had to realize, you know, what is my higher power? And I can profess, you know, I can say prayers all day, and I can say I believe in God and have faith in God, but you know, is money the thing that I really want? If I think I got enough money, is that okay? That sustain me? And I realized that money was my God. My father was my God. I put him on a pedestal he never wanted to be on, that he couldn't live up to. My marriage was my God. If Diane and I were getting along okay, everything's wonderful. But man, the time we had problems, it was down in the pits. You know, my business, sex, bottle of whiskey. You know, of course, I'm my own worst higher power when I just use me. And I even used my sponsor as a higher power. And he had problems for a while, and he was unavailable. So little by little, all the worldly things that I'd really use for a higher power, when I really realized what I lean on, all those things could fail me. And what I was left with is this power that I pray to. And so I started developing a relationship with a God that I still don't understand. But that feeling is stronger with me all the time as I stand up here today. And so I finally get desperate enough to write this four-step, and and because I just can't take it anymore. I'm just ready to kill myself or leave, you know. And so I start writing this four-step down, and I've listed all my resentments, you know, my next-door neighbor for suing me, my wife, my father, and about everybody in the phone book, really. And I wrote down what they'd done to me and how it had caused me problems, how it affected me. You know, that's my favorite topic of being the victim. You know, I always think I was a people pleaser, but, you know, it's because I want something from you. You know, I do things for people because I want something from you. And so I wrote that wrote those three things down, and that was pretty easy to write. Except Buff said, you know, in this fourth column, you need to write down your mistakes. You know, where were you wrong in this, and what did you do to make these resentments worse? And I'd never looked at that before in my life. And that was the first time I started taking responsibility for the actions I'd had, and I didn't like it. I didn't like to see in black and white of who I really was, not who I wanted to be or who I was lying to everybody trying to act like I was and being this chameleon to different groups of people. It was just exactly how I'd lived my life. And it was a sobering fact. I made a fears list. It said, you know, you list your fears, we ask ourselves why we had them, and I write all these reasons why I have these fears in the second column, but that's just a drunk trap because the next sentence is, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And I looked down at all these self-centered fears and realized that, you know, I was my own home group, higher power, and sponsor. That's how I thought I was supposed to power through these fears, and it just wasn't working. I did a sex inventory, and I might as well have just written one story about how I have relationships with women and just put all the names in it, whether they were one-night stands or long-term relationships, including my wife. It was scary. You know, they started out the same way for the same reasons. I treated them the same to get what I wanted, and it was all selfish and self-centered. Sooner or later, it would self-destruct, and I'd go get another one. And by this time, I'm thinking, man, my marriage is so loused up, I don't think this is ever going to work. Because right before I did this inventory, I got all pumped up with that guilt and shame and remorse of cheating on my wife. And I read in the book where we made amends to people, and that we did it in a general way. And I thought I need to get my wife, I just really need to make amends to her. So I got her in a conversation one night and told her in a general way that I had been unfaithful to her. And I really thought she was going to say, well, golly, that was a couple months ago, and now you're sober in AA. You're wonderful. Don't worry about it. It just made things worse. It put her in a lot more pain than she was in. And I've tried a long time to repair that. And I'll tell you more about that in a little bit. But I told my sponsor what I'd done, and I tried to make amends to her. And I mean, he went thermonuclear. I can't tell you what he said. I mean, but I can paraphrase. He said, that's why they numbered the steps for smart college boys like you. You're not on the ninth step. You're not even on the third step. And that's when I became teachable. That was really my bottom, because I didn't want to lose that marriage. And my best thinking sober was just making things worse. So I started paying attention to my sponsor then, and I started doing the steps the way he showed me to. Why in the world would a guy like me want to think I need to reinvent the 12 steps? When there are people out there that have done them for years and are more than willing to pass them on to me. So after doing this inventory, I'm thinking, you know, my marriage is going to be over. And he said, well, why don't you just keep on the path we're on and let God take care of that? So I did a fifth step with this man, and I took this inventory over to his apartment on Saturday morning. And he said, you know, in a fifth step, we admit to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. He said, it says you illuminate every dark cranny. He said, so I want you to empty every secret you've got between yourself and me and God when you come over here. Well, I didn't want to do that, but I started writing this stuff down that I wanted to go to the grave with. And some of the worst stuff I wrote in code, so if anybody found a piece of paper, it wouldn't matter. You know? A little hint for anybody that's on that step. And I go over to his apartment, and I sit down with him, and he said, what's the worst thing on your list? And I look down at the code, and I told him the worst thing that I thought was on there. And he told me the worst thing that was on his list, on his fifth step. Here was another man willing to tell me his deepest, darkest secret to make me comfortable enough to empty this garbage can I had inside. You know, that's real love to me. I think it's been mentioned here this weekend, the nearest I ever fear to doing God's work, the closest I ever feel to God is when I'm doing a four-step with somebody. Or a fifth-step, rather. And so after that, we go through the inventories, and I tell him this stuff, you know, all these secrets I had. But I didn't tell him all of them. And at the end of it, he said, you know, have you left anything out? And I looked down at the code, and there were some things down there that were like that other stuff that I told him. And I thought, well, that's like, my mind just goes to work just like this. You know, that's the same stuff. You don't need to tell him that. So I didn't tell him everything. And he asked me a couple of times, you know, you sure? Yeah, I'm sure. So I leave there and I go out to my office for an hour to be quiet and review the first five steps. And I get about a block from his house and all of a sudden I just feel like somebody's kicked me in the chest because it dawns on me that I didn't tell him everything in that fifth step and I lied to my sponsor. And it just got my attention. But what really got my attention is a good friend of mine was in, out, and in, and out, and in, and out back then. I mean, he couldn't stay sober. And the week before, he came into our men's group and got another white chip because he said he'd done a fifth step and left something out. And the book says, invariably, we drink again. And he drank again. And for the first time, I really thought, you know, if I really think I'm a real alcoholic, you know, if I really think I'm really an alcoholic, if I can't do this stuff cafeteria style, I've got to do all this stuff like everybody else does, or I'm a dead man. And I picked up my phone and I called Buff. I said, man, I hate to call you, but I left something out. And he starts laughing. You know, and I don't think it's funny because I got to tell him this stuff I don't want to tell him, and I lied to him too. And I said, why are you laughing? He said, well, usually it's a couple of hours before they call back. You're easy. So he said, what is it? And I told him. And he said, well, I love you anyway. And I've got to tell a lot of men that I love you anyway when they've let go of their darkest secrets. So I leave and I go and I go to my office and I open the book and I to step 6 and 7. I read through there a paragraph apiece and I'm going, man, paragraph apiece, 6, 7, 2 steps, just like that. Bingo. Finally, after all this sweat and bullets. And by the way, Andy and I were talking about this yesterday. Sometimes I get caught up in the stress and the emotion of doing some step work. But, you know, the steps aren't punishment. Sometimes I always treat it like it's punishment, but it's not. It's a way to freedom. It's the only way I've been able to get out of the hell I lived in all my life. Why I put it off, I'll never know. But the more I can be involved with my people here, and be involved with other people that are taking step work, it makes it easier for me to stay current. And that's such a blessing. But I take these 2 steps, and all I did was read them and say the prayer. I really didn't take the step because I said, hey, God, I'm ready. You take this stuff. But what I really did for the next couple of months is I thought, well, now I know how I loused up my life. I wrote it all down in this inventory. I'm not going to be like that anymore. And I wound up being the same sarcastic, depressive, explosive, angry person I always was. I got sick and tired of being me after a couple of months, and I knew why, and it wasn't doing me any good. I was down in the Florida Keys with my wife visiting her parents one Christmas, and I'm down there, and I cussed out my father-in-law on his boat. I don't know why, but I can't even remember, but I cussed him out on his boat, and I've been living at his house eating his food for a week, and he's taking me fishing, and I cussed him out, dead sober. And we get back to the dock, and I yell at my sons. And, you know, boys are, you know, they're rambunctious at Christmas time. And I call my sponsor, and I said, man, I'm down here in paradise just having a miserable time. Of course, he didn't want to hear it. It was about 10 degrees in Nashville. And he said, well, congratulations, Hoss. You've been trying to remove your own character defects. He said, why don't you find you a quiet place somewhere and get on your knees and say the 7th step prayer like you mean it, and then let's get busy on these amends. And so I did it. And I'd already known I'd loused up that what I thought was an amends to my wife. And by the way, the first thing he told me was, is, Hoss, you didn't make amends to her. All you did was dump your guilt. And that's when I realized that's what I'd done. And so I made this list of all the people that I'd harmed. And I want to tell you about my wife first because that's the most precious to me. I made amends to my wife according to my sponsor's directions the first time around. and after I'd loused up the first time, and it was his best interpretation of the literature and his best shot at it, which was still much better than mine, but it wasn't good enough, and she rejected my amends. But she didn't leave. And I really thought she would get over it in time. I thought, well, just a living amends is going to be proper. You know, that'll wear off in time. But about 5 years into, 5.5 years into sobriety, one of our sons was getting in some trouble. We went to a counselor, and Buff said, you know, you're going to find out that this is not about your son. This is about you and Diane. And sure enough, we weren't in there 5 minutes that all that came up. And through that counselor, I got some information about how what my wife wanted for an amends that would do the best to repair that damage. And I discussed it with my sponsor, and I didn't want to do it because I thought it wouldn't work. I said, she'll leave me if I make this amends the way she wants it. And the only thing Buff asked me, he said, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? I said, if she leaves. And he said, well, could you stay sober? She did. That's all I wanted to know. And I said, well, I don't know. I guess I could, but that's not what I want. But I became willing to make that amends, and I made that amends to her. And that was 18 years ago. And I know the scars will always be there. But that was the amends that she wanted. And we've got a relationship built on honesty and trust, and I worked really hard trying to keep that slate clean. And I'm so grateful that because of Al-Anon, and for our love, that she stayed with me long enough where I could make that amends to her. A lot of people say, I ain't sticking around for 5 or 6 years to make an amends. Well, I want to tell you, it's worth it for me. It's worth it for me. I made amends to my dad. I made a formal amends to him. He loved me the best way he could and gave me all kinds of opportunities. Some of them I just blew apart and took advantage of, and then I wanted to push him out of my life. I tried to make amends to him, and my mother passed away some years before, so, and he couldn't drive anymore. By the way, one of the things, I think when I get sober, everything's just going to be warm and fuzzy all the time, but sometimes I have to make decisions that hurt. One of them was taking his car keys away from him when he started having some wrecks where he couldn't drive, but I was the one that had to do that. You know, my two older sisters were out of town. But I had a pretty good relationship with my dad for a while after I made this amends. Then it fell apart again. And we argued all the time. And we'd argue and scream at each other when I'd drive in places. I called my sponsor just in tears one day. And I said, man, I made amends to this guy, but I still can't get along with him. He said, well, there's something else you need to dig on. And so I had to do some more inventory work on that. And what I found out was that my dad was a guy that had some wealth and some influence. And I took advantage of that every time I could. And he was my shield, my go-to guy if I got in trouble. And even though at this time I'm 40 years old, been making my way in the world for a long time, you know, self-supporting through my own contributions, I never wanted to make him angry or upset because I was afraid I might get cut off from that source. And I told him that. I told my sponsor, I said, it's just my greed, you know. I don't want to run him off because I want his money. And he said, well, that's easy. He said, just get on your knees and pray the next 3 weeks every night that when he dies, he leaves everything to your sisters. And I thought he was nuts, but I was in so much pain, you know, that's what I did. And I got free of that. I got free of that. And he passed away not long after that. And I always, a long time ago, I used to say we never had a good relationship, but the truth is we ran out of time. We ran out of time. I wound up retiring from that business almost 10 years ago. And if we didn't have that business atmosphere between us, it would have been better. And if I'd been sober longer, I don't know whether he would have ever got sober, but I know we would have had a better relationship. And we just ran out of time. And I have fond memories of my dad today, and I didn't for years, but I do today. And, I've got to tell you about my neighbor. I told you all the gory details about that, so... Undercover arborist. Chief shot. All right, Buff tells me, you know, when I make these amends, you know, I just wrote down the names and wrote the harm and just gave them to him and said, here, man, tell me what to do. And he gave me explicit instructions how to make amends to people. And he said, you know, when you go make amends to somebody, you don't just go tell them you're sorry. He said, they know what a sorry son of a gun you are. He said, now you can go apologize to him, but on your neighbor, you need to go apologize to him, but you need to do something for them. He said, you're trying to repair the damage you caused somebody. If you can't do it without causing further harm to them, you don't do it. You stay willing. And I have a couple of those that I'll probably never be able to make because they can cause further harm, but I'm still willing. But he said, on your neighbor, this is easy. He said, you need to go apologize to him for cutting his trees down, and then you need to plant him another weeping cherry tree. He said, now you don't need to tell him you know how it died. You know, that won't add anything to it to know that you poisoned it, you know. And so, I don't know about you, but when I get the news and some instructions on an amend, it seems like those people just appear. I mean, like a day or two later, I pull in my driveway, and I see him out there on his riding lawnmower. I was coming back from the back room group on a Sunday morning. And I pull in, and I stop at the bottom of my driveway, and my heart starts beating pretty fast. And I said, God, I don't know exactly how I'm supposed to do this, but please give me the right words to say. And I got out of my car, and I walked around the 6-foot-high wood fence that I put up between us after he sued me to try to scream out. And I walk over to him, and he's out there on his riding lawnmower. I just realized not long ago that before I cut his trees down, he didn't even own a lawnmower. Like I said, I bought him a lawnmower. Huh? But he had a lawn to cut to. And he's out there on his riding lawnmower. And as I'm walking around the fence over in his yard, he sees me coming, and I could see his eyes. I could see the fear in his eyes. He was really afraid of me. And I walked over to him, and he turned. He had this look like, "Can I get the lawnmower in a high enough gear to outrun this clown? Or, you know, should I abandon ship and run?" You know, he really was afraid of me. But he turned the lawnmower off, and I walked over to him, and I said, "Mr. Logan, can I talk to you for a minute?" And he said, "Sure, what is it?" And I said, "I did a terrible thing cutting your trees down years ago, and I've disrespected you and your wife for a long time. And I wish I hadn't done any of those things. I'm trying to change some things in my life, and I don't know what I can do to ever make up for the damage I've caused you. But if there's anything I can do, whatever it is, I'm willing to do it." Now, I didn't mean to say that. I really didn't. I didn't mean to say I'll do whatever you want me to do. I really didn't. But I asked God to direct what came out of my mouth, and that's what came out. And I really thought the man would say, "Well, just get off my property and don't you ever come near me again." Because that's the way I treated people. If you got in my way, you're out of here. And if he would have said that, I would have honored that. You know, sometimes we hurt people beyond their capacity to love us. And they want us to leave them alone, and that's what we do. But instead, he came over to me, and he put his arms around me, and he started hugging me, and he started crying. And he held me for a little bit. And he pulled back, and he looked me right in the eyes, and he said, "What's in the past is over." He just forgave me right there. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, run. I thought, run. Okay, he's forgiven you. Run. Now, on my own, I would have done that. But I had clear instructions from my sponsor in this ninth step what to do. And I'm so grateful I did, because if I hadn't had that, I would have missed what I'm going to tell you. And I said, "I really appreciate you forgiving me, but I really want to do something to make up for the damage I've caused you." And he said, "Well, you already have." He said, "The thing that hurt us the most is that my wife and I had lost our neighbor. And we've been praying every day that we'd get our neighbor back, and now our prayers have been answered." I've been cussing him every day, and he's been praying for me. My sponsor told me a couple of years ago that if I get to where my higher power's not big enough, he said, "Why don't you just borrow Mr. Logan's for a little while?" I said, "Well, I appreciate you forgiving me, but I really want to do something to make up for it." And he said, "You already have by coming over here." And I said, "Well, I noticed your cherry tree died over there." Could I plant you another tree?" And he said, "Oh, you don't have to do that." And I said, "Well, I'd like to if you'll let me." And he said, "Well, Miss Logan would like that." And I didn't have my people anymore at this time. My business was pretty bad then. And so my older son, who was 12 at the time, and I went and got a bigger weeping cherry tree, and we planted that weeping cherry tree in his yard. And I carry a letter in my big book that I want to share with you that I got from this man. This is dated June 26, 1991. Dear Mike, it was with much surprise that we found the beautiful cherry tree in our yard when we returned home yesterday. We had not expected it so soon. We appreciate it so very much, and we will care for it and will cherish it always, not only for its own sake, for it symbolizes, for it is a beautiful tree, but because it symbolizes a deep and lasting friendship between us and you and your family. We pray that God will bless you and all that, and your family and all that you do, and we pray for ourselves, for we are a sinful people by nature. There are none of us without fault, and we need His constant love and forgiveness. Again, we thank you for the tree. We're all the more grateful because you did not have to do it. Your friendship means more to us than you know. Most sincerely, George Logan. And this man gave us a country ham every year for Christmas until he died. When my father died, about a year later, the very first flowers that came to the funeral home was a wreath of purple orchids from Mr. Logan, and I've still got one of them on my desk at home. When he passed away, I went to his funeral. You guys have showed me, taught me to show up for funerals and weddings and graduations that I used to be too busy for. And I remember going to this man's visitation. I'm shaking hands with people. I don't know anybody there. And I shake hands with this one man, and he said, "Oh, yeah, you're Mr. Allison. Dad told us about you." I'm going, "Oh, great." He said that you'd had a misunderstanding, but that you'd made it right. But you see, I didn't make it right. I was desperate enough to do the steps and follow my sponsor's instructions on that ninth step. And after I did that, I started getting a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, that's when the promises start coming true for a guy like me. And I've seen it happen over and over again with people. You know, I'm lucky enough to have the tenth step to stay current with the stuff that comes up, wreckage of the present. And I've got an 11th step where I can improve that conscious contact with that God I have. The 12th step, I get to be a free man and try to give this stuff away. I want to tell you a couple of little stories if I got time. My sponsor contracted a terminal illness, and he died when I was 10 and a half years sober. And he died real slowly. And people were saying, "Who are you going to get for a sponsor when Buff leaves?" And I said, I just put him off. Said, "Well, Buff's my sponsor until he dies." Well, he died. And so a couple of guys said, "Who are you going to get for a sponsor now?" And I put them off too. I said, "Well, you know, I'm going to get one." But then I had this thing in my head, this meeting in my head that said, "You know, you're 10 and a half years sober. You worked all the steps. Your business is good. Your family's back. You know what Buff would tell you anyway. You probably don't need to get another sponsor right now." And I thought, that is nuts. You know, I'd have an idiot for a sponsor. So I picked up my phone and I called Terry. And Terry was also sponsored by Buff, and he was 6 months ahead of me. And I got to see him go through the steps, and I saw the promises come true for him when he did when he made his amends. And I rode Terry's coattails. He was an attraction to me. So I called Terry and I said, "Look, I just had this conversation in my head that I don't need to get another sponsor. That's crazy. Will you be my sponsor?" And he said, "Yeah, but I'm not Buff." And you see, I got contempt prior to investigation. I think I know what I need all the time. I think I know everything. But Terry's not like Buff at all. Terry's been my sponsor now for longer than Buff was. He's been my sponsor for over 14 years. He's a wonderful man. I've learned more about being a husband and a father and a grandfather from him. He's a steady rock that lives one day at a time. And that's priceless. But why I tell you this is I thought I was reaching out to him for me. But he was having the same conversation in his head that he didn't need to get another sponsor either since Buff died. And when I called him, after we hung up, he picked up the phone and called another guy and said, "Well, I wasn't going to get another sponsor, but Allison said he needs one, so I guess I do too. Will you be mine?" So any action I take, I never know who I'm helping. When been sober a while, our younger son was in the eighth grade. I'm going to AA. My wife's in Al-Anon. My sons are in Alateen. We're going to Al-Dog, Al-Cat. I mean, we're the recovery family, you know. And I get this phone call one day at work. It says, we found your son with some marijuana and we've got zero tolerance. He's out of school for a year. Come get him right now. And I'm going, this can't be happening to me. Not to us. We're the recovery family. And I go pick him up, and I remember being so angry. And we couldn't get him in another school in the middle of the year. Private school doesn't want a kid kicked out of public school for drugs in the middle of the year. So about a month goes by, and we finally get him into an alternative learning center. But the catch was is I had to pick him up every day within a five-minute window. 5 minutes to 2 o'clock is when you had to pick him up. And I thought, is this my reward for being sober and doing this? I have to leave my sod farm and go all the way across Nashville, the other side of town, pick him up, either take him to our house in South Nashville or go all the way back out to work with him. And I thought, what a raw deal this is going to be. But what it did was it forced me to spend time with my son that I wouldn't have spent. I had time with him every day. I worked all the time, and I wouldn't have spent that time with him. He's 32 years old now. He's lived in Northern California for 11 and a half years, and living the great life he wants to live. And I have a bond with him because I was forced to do that. And so I never know the actions I take, how it's going to turn out, you know. I'm supposed to just do what's in front of me. I read part of that, the Day of the Reflections, on April 19th, and I want to read the other half of it here. It says, the identification that one alcoholic has with another is mysterious, spiritual, almost incomprehensible. But it is there. I feel it. Today I feel that I can help people and they can help me. It's a new and exciting feeling for me to care for someone, to care for what they're feeling, hoping for, praying for, to know their sadness, joy, horror, sorrow, grief, to want to share those feelings so that someone can have relief. I never knew how to do this or how to try. I never even cared. The fellowship of AA and God are teaching me how to care for others. You know, my friend Don back home says, we're the blessed ones. We get to live a second life in the same lifetime. I'm so grateful to be with you today. Thanks for listening.